All right. So as I told Dean, and he sent out in the email of the guide, the study guide for you, this is week 18 of 24 weeks. So we are 3/4 of the way through our study of Jeremiah. We'll have 5 more lessons after tonight. So basically, we finished the last Sunday in February. So that'll wrap up Jeremiah. Tonight is the culmination of what the Lord has been telling Jeremiah to tell everybody. That is, we are going to see the fall of Jerusalem tonight and the complete destruction of Jerusalem and of the temple. So we'll get into it. We'll be covering chapters 37, 38, and 39 tonight. It seems like a lot, but these chapters are pretty short and they're all to the point, dealing with this piece of history in Judah and Jerusalem's past. So let's look at the chronology again. Since we're dealing with chapter 37, it starts out just before 587 BC. So we're looking at, just maybe 18 months before the walls of Jerusalem are penetrated by the Babylonians with this chapter. But from our study last week, and where we ended in chapter 36, we've skipped ahead from where we were in chapter 36 by almost 16 years. And as it stands right now in the year 588, Babylon has surrounded Jerusalem and is currently building siege walls to try and break the walls of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is defending itself. And as it stands right now, as we'll get into this lesson, as it stands right now in Jerusalem, there is some food. They haven't been completely cut off yet from the outside of Jerusalem yet. So, and you'll see that in just a minute. And I think I said that we're in the middle of the siege. We're not yet. Actually, with chapter 37 as it starts, the siege has not quite started yet. We're probably either months or weeks away from Babylon sieging against Jerusalem, but not quite yet. And I built this chart. I thought it would be useful for everybody because you kind of get confused about the relationships of the kings. And so I thought it would be important to just share a little bit of that with you. So when we started Jeremiah, we were looking at Josiah's reign. Josiah had been king for about 8 years when Jeremiah started to prophesy. Josiah reigned for 31 years. He was a good king. He tried to reform Judah and Jerusalem. He did his very best to bring back the old law, to bring back the Sabbath, to bring back sacrificing to the Lord only, not to other gods. He did his very best, but he was foolish at the end of his reign, and it cost him his life. When he died in that battle on the plains of Megiddo against the Pharaoh, who was coming up to try and help Assyria in their battle with Babylon, Josiah stalled Egypt just long enough for Babylon to utterly wipe out Assyria. But it cost Josiah his life. He died in that battle against the Egyptians. His son, Jehoahaz, was made king at the age of 23 by the people after Josiah's death at the hands of the Pharaoh. And he reigned for 3 months before he rebelled against the Pharaoh and he was carried away into Egyptian captivity. So Jehoahaz had a very short reign. When Josiah died in that battle against Egypt, the Pharaoh basically turned Judah into a buffer zone. And Jehoahaz rebelled against that. He did not want to pay the tribute to the Pharaoh. And so the Pharaoh came and took Jehoahaz to Egypt, and that's where he died. So next, Josiah's son Eliakim took over, and he was made king of Judah by Pharaoh at age 25 and renamed Jehoiakim by the Pharaoh. He was forced to pay tribute to Egypt as a buffer zone, again, between Egypt and Babylon. But shortly thereafter, Nebuchadnezzar captured Jerusalem. That was in the year 597. When he did that,
that's it, 597.
When he did that, he put Jehoiakim as his king, or kept Jehoiakim as his king, and made Judah pay tribute to Babylon instead of Egypt. At the same time that Babylon conquered Judah, at this time under Jehoiakim's reign, Babylon also pushed Egypt all the way back to Egypt, and they basically ruled the land between the Nile and the Euphrates. So there was nothing standing in Babylon's way then. Jehoiakim rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and because of that rebellion, he was carried away into Babylonian captivity. His son, that is Josiah's grandson, Jehoiachin, inherited the throne by line of succession from his father Jehoiakim, and he took over at age 18. He also reigned for only 3 months, did not want to serve Babylon, and so Babylon came up against Jerusalem again. Jehoiachin, or Jeconiah, or Coniah, he surrendered the way the Judah and the Israelites were told to by God. And because he surrendered, he was not killed. He and his queen and many of the nobles and a lot of the rich people in Jerusalem were carried away into Babylonian captivity. And at that time, the Babylonians also took a lot of the temple gold and the articles. So they lost a lot of what had been in the temple at that time. When Jeconiah left, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, put Josiah's son, Mattaniah, in the place of the king and renamed him as Zedekiah. So he was given his kingship by Nebuchadnezzar at the age of 21. And he was a puppet king who ruled at the whim of the king of Babylon for 11 years. He also rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar and tried to flee from the Babylonian army, and that's the story we're going to look at tonight. He was captured in the plains of Jericho. He was brought back to Jerusalem, and he was tried by the Babylonian authorities. His children were killed before his eyes, and then his eyes were put out, and he was led away to Babylon in bronze chains. That will be the end of the line of David. Zedekiah, Josiah's son, was the last king of Israel that was in the line of David. And that ends that physical line on the throne in Jerusalem. Also, because of Zedekiah's actions, the city was burned, the walls were torn down, and the temple was destroyed. So I hope that gives you a little bit of more understanding of the family relationships there. Makes it a little more clear to me. I thought, you know, the Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Jeconiah, Coniah. Well, the names all get really confusing after a while. You don't know who's who. But when you put them in a chart like that, it makes it a whole lot easier to see that three of the kings after Josiah were his sons. And one was his grandson, that being Jehoiakim's grandson, or Jehoiakim's son, sorry, Jehoiachin. And two of those kings, Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin, only ruled for 3 months. They had very short reigns, but you'll notice that all of these men took over the kingship at the age of 25 or less. So they weren't very educated, they weren't very trained. They didn't really know a whole lot about doing this, but, you know, neither did Josiah. He took over at the age of 8, and he seemed to have 31 years of blessed rain. But again, that just depends on, I guess, who raises you. And Josiah was obviously raised by somebody who was godly, who taught him about God, but he failed to teach his kids that same thing because all of those kings were evil. Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah were all kings who did not go after God, who decided to go after idolatry, and who went after the kings, or who went after the gods that Manasseh and Ammon had set up. So that being the case, we understand where we are. We're in the last year and a half or 2 years of Zedekiah's reign. So we start chapter 37 with Zedekiah hoping in vain that he'll get some help from Egypt. So after the Chaldeans departed from besieging Jerusalem because Egypt was coming, what message was Jeremiah instructed to give King Zedekiah?
Behold, Pharaoh's army, which has come out to assist for your assistance, is going to return to its own land. The Chaldeans will also return and fight against this city, and they will capture and burn it.
Exactly. So there we are. The siege against Jerusalem had started but ended because the Egyptian army was coming up against the Babylonians. So they stopped the siege and they faced south and went to go up against Egypt. But that didn't happen. And the Lord told Jeremiah to tell Zedekiah, don't deceive yourself. You cannot win this. Even if your army conquered the Chaldean army and only wounded soldiers were left, they would still defeat you and burn the city. Regardless of how strong or mighty you think you are, if you do not do what I told you, which is surrender to the Babylonian army and go into captivity, it's going to cost you your life. It's going to cost you the lives of your people. And it's going to cost you the city. And we're going to see that in just a minute. He was given the option to surrender and maybe save the city. Maybe the walls not get destroyed. Maybe the temple not get destroyed. But he ignored that. So Jeremiah is imprisoned in the house of Jonathan the scribe. What false accusation did Arijah make when Jeremiah was in the gate of Benjamin? So to put that in perspective, this must have been at the time after the Babylonian army had left. Jeremiah was going to go out of the gate of Benjamin to finalize the deal on some land he had bought in the southern tribe. And so he was going out of the gate of Jerusalem and he gets stopped by Arijah. And what false accusation did Arijah make against Jeremiah?
You are going over to the Chaldeans.
Right. So he says, Jeremiah is going to defect. Arijah accuses Jeremiah of defecting to the Chaldean army. That's a different idea between defecting and surrendering. Basically, Arijah was calling Jeremiah a traitor, saying that he was going to defect to the army, give information to the Babylonians, accusing him of being not a stellar Jew, of being a defector. So who took Jeremiah out of prison and why?
Zedekiah.
That's right. So this is the first time that Jeremiah is rescued from prison. And this house of Jonathan the scribe that had been converted into a jail or dungeon was obviously not a very nice place to be. Jeremiah is going to tell us about there in just a minute. I think in verse 16 it says, for Jeremiah had come into the dungeon, that is the vaulted cell, and Jeremiah stayed there many days. And then when Zedekiah, in verse 17, took him out and in his palace, the king secretly asked him this question, Jeremiah is going to say, don't send me back there because that place is a nightmare. So after their conversation, after Zedekiah asks Jeremiah what he asked him, where did Zedekiah commit Jeremiah to?
Courtyard of the guardhouse.
Yeah, right. So the courtyard of the guardhouse instead of that nasty dungeon that he had been in. And Zedekiah took him out of prison in the first place because he wanted to ask him a question. He asked Jeremiah, is there a word from the Lord? And Jeremiah said in verse 17, there is. Then he said, you will be given into the hand of the king of Babylon. I've been telling you that for the last 30 years. Going on probably 40 years now. I've been telling your father that. I told all of your brothers that. I told your brothers or your nephew that the king of Babylon is going to take this city and all of the people. And in verse 18, moreover, Jeremiah said to King Zedekiah, in what way have I sinned against you or against your servants or against this people that you have put me in prison? And where then are your prophets who prophesied to you saying the king of Babylon will not come against you or against this land? And we saw those prophets prophesying over the past two decades. We looked at those in the earlier chapters of Jeremiah, these prophets, some of whom were cursed by Jeremiah and by God because of what they tried to do to Jeremiah or because of what they were prophesying, and died early deaths. And Jeremiah says in verse 20, but now please listen, O Lord, my king. Please let my petition come before you and do not make me return to the house of Jonathan the scribe, that I may not die there. He doesn't want to go back there. He's afraid he's going to die in that nasty dungeon. And so Zedekiah gives a commandment to commit him to the court of the guardhouse. And he's to be given a loaf of bread daily from the baker's street until all the bread in the city was gone. So Jeremiah was put in this, let's call it minimum security prison, and fed well during a siege on the city in which he would have probably been starving to death. Because once that siege starts, no food's coming into the city. No people are going out of the city unless they're going out as captives. They don't have any really easy access to their land outside where they're growing their crops and such. There's not enough room inside the city for their flocks or anything like that, except for minimal whatever people were keeping in their personal houses. But that's not going to last you 18 months, 2 years of a siege. So we're going to see that the people are going to die from exactly what the Lord said: famine, pestilence, that is death from all sorts of diseases because of all the dead bodies around them, and the sword. And that is, once the Babylonians break through the wall of Jerusalem, there is nothing to stop them from slaughtering everybody. So we see at the end of this first part here in verse 21, Jeremiah remained in the court of the guardhouse.
Ted, I look at this and I try to understand Zedekiah. I think what he did was he assumed that Jeremiah was a prophet just like all the other corrupt prophets that he'd been dealing with, and that, it would be enough to get Jeremiah to change his tune if I just threw him into jail. But Jeremiah was not like those prophets that he was used to dealing with. And so he keeps calling him back saying, you got a word for me? It's as if he's questioning whether Jeremiah has changed his tune.
Yeah, exactly. And he's hoping that by mistreating Jeremiah, he'll get a better answer, one he likes better. And of course, that's not going to happen. And even we're going to see in the next chapter, Jeremiah is in prison, not because Zedekiah commands that, but because Zedekiah is indifferent about what happens to Jeremiah and allows whatever to happen to Jeremiah. He's a savior here this first time, where Elijah falsely accuses him. And we'll see he's saved two more times from jail or from being in prison somewhere that's absolutely nasty. But all throughout this, Zedekiah is just denying the truth, ignoring what's happening around him, and is absolutely unwilling to bow his knee to God and to surrender to the Babylonians as he's been commanded. So as we start into, I think we're still in 37. Yeah. Jeremiah is imprisoned in the house of Jonathan the scribe. And no, I'm sorry. I hit the backwards button. My fault. Hold on. Let me get this out of here. Okay. Yeah, that ends chapter 37. We're going to bump into 38 and 39. So again, we're going to look at the chronology chart. So we're now skipping ahead about 18 months. So by the time we're in chapter 38, the city has been under siege by the Babylonians for about 18 months. There was a short time where maybe a few weeks where they left the siege to go and take care of the Egyptians, but then they turned right back around and came back to the siege. So we're in the year 586 now. That is the year that Jerusalem falls. We're just weeks or months away from the end. And the Babylonian army and Nebuchadnezzar are knocking at the door. They are ready to come into the city. Oh, I went backwards again. Let me stop doing that. So evil men request permission from Zedekiah to put Jeremiah to death. And so let's look at that for a minute. What reason did the princes give to the king for permission to put Jeremiah to death?
But he weakeneth the hand of the men at war.
Right. They were saying that Jeremiah's prophecies were so discouraging that the men of war who were left in the city, and he is seeking to harm their well-being, the well-being of the people of Jerusalem. He is causing discouragement among who is left in the city to defend the city, is what their accusation is. And how deplorable was the place described where Jeremiah was placed?
A cistern full of mire, no water and no food.
Exactly. So he's thrown into this water storage area, a giant hole in the ground, basically, that was put there to hold water, but the water has long since been used up after 18 months of siege. No rain. God said there would be famine, and what usually accompanies famine? No rain. Usually the famine is going to be caused because you can't grow your crops. They're also holed up in their city, so they're not going to have much area to grow anyway. But he's put in this deep water cistern with no water in it, just mud. And it sounds like, if you read about it in verse 6, now in the cistern there was no water, only mud, and Jeremiah sank into the mud. So it's not only is it like muddy, like you're getting your shoes dirty, he's like hip deep in mud. It's a nightmare. It's probably the worst thing you can imagine, being buried in something like that. And, you know, that's just taking years off your life, and disease and the chance of dying has greatly increased for Jeremiah. So Jeremiah is rescued. This is the second time he's rescued from a horrible dungeon-like area. This time it's by Ebed-Melech. And so who is or who was Ebed-Melech?
The Cushite.
He was Ethiopian eunuch.
Yes, correct. He's a Cushite. He's of the Ethiopian peoples. He is also a eunuch. And Ebed-Melech went to Zedekiah to ask him if it would be okay if he could get Jeremiah out of the place that those people had put him. If we look back at the previous six verses, those evil men who were saying that Jeremiah was discouraging the people. Zedekiah kind of went, you know, do whatever you want. I don't really care what you do to him. And it was their intention to kill him by throwing him in the cistern and letting him starve to death, letting him die in there. So Ibn Melek, this Ethiopian eunuch, says, no, King Zedekiah, we can't let a prophet be treated like this. He said in verse 9, my lord the king, these men have acted wickedly in all that they have done to Jeremiah, the prophet, whom they have cast into the cistern, and he will die right where he is because of the famine, for there is no more bread in the city. And so the king commanded Ebed Melek, said, take 30 men from here under your authority and bring up Jeremiah the prophet from the cistern before he dies. So Ebed Melek took the men from under his authority and went to the king's palace to a place beneath the storeroom and took from there worn out clothes and worn out rags and let them down by ropes into the cistern. And then Ibn Melek and the Ethiopian said to Jeremiah, put these worn out rags under your armpits under the ropes. And Jeremiah did so, and they pulled him up with the ropes and lifted him out of the cistern. So I think the point here is, I don't know if any of you have ever dealt with somebody who is stuck in the mud, but when I was growing up on the Turnagain Flats, there would be people who would go out there fishing and clamming in their hip waders. But when the tide went out, you would sink into that area. If you weren't careful and you stayed in one place too long, you would sink up to your knees or even further. And more than once, I saw people in the news who died in Anchorage because they went out on those flats either clamming or fishing or doing something like that, got stuck in the mud and couldn't get out. And then when the tide came in, they drowned. Or when people tried to pull them out, they did major bodily damage to them trying to get them out of the mud. You've probably seen in movies people going in quicksand, like Indiana Jones, you know, getting stuck in the quicksand. It's not easy to get out of that. It's it has a real grip on you. And so they use these rags in order for those ropes not to do bodily harm to Jeremiah as they pulled him out of that miry, muddy, mucky mess that he was stuck in. And it took several men, obviously, to lift him out of that cistern. So Zedekiah is given two options by Jeremiah. What options did Jeremiah give the king when he spoke with him at the third entrance of the house of the Lord?
If you will go forth to the king of Babylonia, princess, then this city will be given to the Chaldeans, be burned, correct, and thou wilt not escape.
So the first option was surrender. If in verse 17, thus says the Lord God of hosts, if you indeed go out to the officers of the king of Babylon, then you will live. The city will not be burned with fire, and you and your household will survive. What's option number two?
If you don't surrender.
If you don't surrender, if you continue to resist this Babylonian captivity that I told you you're going into, in verse 18, it says, then this city will be given over into the hands of the Chaldeans, and they will burn it with fire, and you yourself will not escape their hand. So Zedekiah, again here, is given an opportunity to prevent complete destruction of Jerusalem, to save the city, to save the people who are dying of hunger, who are dying of disease, who are dying, who are going to die from the sword once the Babylonians conquer the city. And in verse 19, the king said to Jeremiah, I dread the Jews who have gone over to the Chaldeans, for they may give me over into their hand and they will abuse me. He's afraid that if he surrenders, if he looks like he's weak, then the Jews who have been captured already, against their will, supposedly, Zedekiah will be given to those Jews, and they're going to beat him. They're going to try and kill him for surrendering, for showing weakness as the king. But Jeremiah said, they will not give you over. That is, the Chaldeans won't give you over to them. Please obey the Lord in what I am saying to you, that it may go well with you and you may live. But if you keep refusing to go out, this is the word of the Lord which he has shown me. Then behold, all of the women who have been left in the palace of the king of Judah are going to be brought out to the officers of the king of Babylon. And those women will say, your close friends have misled and overpowered you. While your feet were sunk in the mire, they turned back. They will also bring out all your wives and your sons to the Chaldeans, and you yourself will not escape from their hand, but will be seized by the hand of the king of Babylon, and the city will be burned with fire. Zedekiah has seen over the last 10 years the things that Jeremiah has been telling him come to pass. He has been seeing Jeremiah's prophecy being fulfilled. He has no reason anymore to doubt what Jeremiah has been saying. His whole kingship, the whole time he's been king, he has heard Jeremiah's prophecies. And now he's seeing it come to pass. All of those false prophets who are prophesying safety, were prophesying that Babylon will go away, that Jerusalem won't be destroyed, they're all gone. There is no one for Zedekiah to stand next to. He doesn't trust anybody anymore except Jeremiah, because he knows from the word of God that a prophet is known to be a true prophet when what he says comes to pass. And what Jeremiah has said has come to pass. Zedekiah has no reason to doubt him, but he continues to resist. So Jeremiah is told to keep his conversation with the king quiet. In verse 24, Zedekiah said to Jeremiah, let no man know about these words, and you will not die. But if the officials hear that I have talked with you, and they come to you and say, tell us now what the king said to you, do not hide it from us, and we will not put you to death, then you are to say to them, I was presenting my petition before the king, not to make me return to the house of Jonathan to die there. So where was Jeremiah when the city of Jerusalem was taken?
He stayed in the courthouse of the court of the guardhouse.
Correct. He was in the court of the guardhouse. And in verse 27, these officials did come to Jeremiah and question him about his conversation with the king. And he reported to them in accordance with all the words the king had commanded. And if you look at it right here, it would be easy to think that Jeremiah lied, but Jeremiah didn't lie. He just told them the truth about what he had asked the king. He told the king, I don't want to go back to the house of Jonathan or to Jonathan the scribe. I don't want to go back to that dungeon. I don't want to be in that mess. He didn't lie. He just didn't tell them the things they didn't need to know because the king had told him not to. And so it was a private conversation. No one overheard it. So Jeremiah stayed in the court of the guardhouse until the day that Jerusalem was captured, because in verse 27, since the conversation had not been overheard, they ceased speaking with Jeremiah because they didn't have any reason not to trust what he said. They didn't have any reason to doubt that Jeremiah was telling them exactly what they needed to know. So the city of Jerusalem is penetrated by Nebuchadnezzar. When was the city penetrated by the Babylonians?
In the 11th year of Zedekiah, on the 4th month and the 9th day.
Exactly. So this would be the 586 BC, the date we're given exact time when Babylon entered into Jerusalem. And we see that all the officials of the king of Babylon came in and sat down at the middle gate. And it names all of these officials and the rest of the officials of the king of Babylon. They just flooded into the city and they sat down. They were right at the main gate of the city. There was nothing that the the people of Judah could do to stop them. They were overwhelmed by an overpowering army because God was with the Babylonians, not with Judah. Zedekiah was given a final opportunity to prevent this from happening. He was given a final opportunity to give up, to save his own life. And as we're going to read later on or as was stated in the previous chapter, in chapter 38, you will gain your life as your booty. He says the same thing to Ebed-Melech at the end of this chapter. You will gain your life as the reward of following what I said. And that is to surrender to the Babylonians, to allow them to take the city, to allow them to take you into captivity. So Zedekiah and his men are caught and carried away into Babylon. So when the Babylonians break through the walls, what does Zedekiah do?
Zedekiah and the soldiers reveal their real character, and they deserted them.
Exactly. Zedekiah and the men of war fled. They went out through the city at night by the way of the king's garden, through the gate between the two walls, and they went out into the Arabah, which is the desert area. So they fled into the desert. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And we're going to see what happened to him here. When Zedekiah was caught in the plains of Jericho by the Chaldeans, how was he judged?
His eyes were put out and he was killed.
Well, let's first and foremost say this. Who judged him?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Nebuchadnezzar, the king, personally. They seized him in verse 5. They seized Zedekiah and brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, at Riblah in the land of Hamath, and he passed sentence on him. Nebuchadnezzar judged Zedekiah, and exactly what God told him was going to happen if he did not surrender, that Nebuchadnezzar was going to be the death of him. Now, he didn't kill him, but he judged him. And so he got to watch Nebuchadnezzar slay his sons before his eyes, and then Nebuchadnezzar put his eyes out. Then he put him in bronze chains and led him back to Babylon. This could have all been avoided. Zedekiah could have, and his family, his sons, his queen, his wives, they could have all lived. They would have been in captivity, but they would have lived the way the rest of God's people who had been taken into captivity were living. They were being taken care of. They were planting their gardens, building their houses, having kids, giving their children into marriage, having children. But Zedekiah chose the wrong path. And it cost him his family, and it cost him his vision. And that's why it's said that Zedekiah never saw Babylon. He was taken to Babylon, and he was alive when he got there. But he didn't have eyes to see it because Nebuchadnezzar had taken his eyes.
Ted.
Yeah, go ahead.
It also says that he slew all the nobles of Judah. What would that be like? People in charge or of something or the other?
Whoever was left who were nobles were also killed as well. You are correct. Yeah. He blinded Zedekiah's eyes. Let's see. I think it's in verse 6. He slew the sons of Zedekiah, and then the king of Babylon also slew the nobles of Judah. So those rich people who had Zedekiah surrendered would have been taken into captivity, were slain, died by the sword. Who did the Babylonians leave in the land of Judah as they carried away the captives of the city?
peoples of all.
Yeah, so the poorest of the poor who had nothing to help Babylon, who were probably too weak to be slaves, to do anything worthwhile, who had nothing for the Babylonians to take. Verse 10 tells us, but some of the poorest people who had nothing, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, left behind in the land of Judah and gave them vineyards and fields at the time. I mean, no reason to let the land just go to fallow, go to waste. So the poorest of the poor who had nothing, now they had something. They had the vineyards to tend. They had the fields to grow crops. So there was a very, very small minority of people that were left. But they were the very poorest of the poor who were left in Judah. So Jeremiah is released from prison, minimum security prison. He was in the court of the guardhouse. And he's committed to Gedaliah. What instructions were given to Nebuzaradan concerning Jeremiah?
Take him and look after him and do nothing harmful to him, but rather deal with him just as he tells you.
Exactly. So look after him, do nothing harmful to him, and whatever Jeremiah tells you you need to do for him, do for him. Make sure that you take care of him. And we see this in verse 11. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, gave orders about Jeremiah. Huh. Isn't that interesting? What was Jeremiah to Nebuchadnezzar?
Prophet who prophesied that Nebuchadnezzar was the winner and they should bow down to him.
Exactly. I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar had heard these prophecies, had heard these stories, and Nebuchadnezzar being God's army against his people, God's chosen person to make all this come to pass. I doubt Nebuchadnezzar had forethought or foremind of what was going on here, but he recognized God's authority. So what message did Jeremiah have for Ebed-Melech? This is the Ethiopian eunuch who pleaded for Jeremiah's life and helped him out of that miry pit.
He would be spared.
Exactly. God will deliver him from the calamity because Ebed-Melech trusted in the Lord. And that's important. We see that this Ethiopian was spared by God because he trusted in God. And I think it's in verse 18, for I will certainly rescue you and you will not fall by the sword, but you will have your own life as booty because you trusted me, declares the Lord. So Jeremiah was happy to be able to repay to Ebed-Melech the kindness that Ebed-Melech gave him. And that was that he would not die by the sword. He would not be killed by the Babylonians. But he would have his life and he would be able to go back to Ethiopia if that was because he was, it said, part of what we read about Ebed-Melech was he was in the court. So he was similar to the Ethiopian eunuch that we read that Philip runs into, that he was probably in the court of the Ethiopian ruler at the time. So this Ethiopian eunuch is going to keep his life and going to be able to go back to where he lives because he trusted in the Lord. That rounds out chapter 39 and finishes off Jerusalem. Part of what happened here because of Zedekiah's stubborn ignorance was the Babylonians broke into the city, burned the city, burned the temple, took as much as they wanted out of the temple. There was almost nothing left. And there were some pretty big things that they took out of that temple that weighed a whole lot of solid bronze, solid gold, silver. They took some really heavy stuff out of the temple. And then they destroyed the temple. And then the Babylonian army broke down the walls of Jerusalem. Utter destruction to the city because Zedekiah made a bad choice. Because he didn't listen to Jeremiah. He didn't listen to God. It cost him his family, cost him his eyesight, and he still went into captivity. Unfortunate, because he could have spared a whole lot of people their lives had he just listened. So some lessons and applications we can get from this. So when Egypt came to Jerusalem and the Chaldeans left, the city thought they were saved. We must guard against putting our hopes of deliverance in men. They can never thwart God's plan. We should never hope that somebody is going to help us when we know that that's not going to be the case. Judah knew what was coming. The Lord had used Jeremiah over a span of 40 years to help prepare Judah for what was coming, but they ignored him. They did not listen to him. They tried to kill him multiple times. And because of that, they thought that they were going to thwart what Jeremiah was saying. But you will not thwart God's plans by being stubborn and ignorant. It won't happen. And when we consider the imprisonments of Jeremiah in our text, we can see one who has had to endure so much more than we have. I can't imagine the not knowing where your next meal was coming from over an 18-month period, dealing with being put in prison, being thrown in horrible dungeons. And how often do we take for granted our blessings and freedoms? We say that over and over again, but as we read the story, we need to really realize how blessed we are. Because even in this world, at this time, there are a lot of people who are less fortunate than we are. And when we see God taking care of Jeremiah, even in the worst of the worst, we should remember that he had to endure some horrible things. And what would you be willing to endure for the cause of Christ? It really puts it into perspective when you see what the Lord's prophets had to go through to spread the message, to bring God's word directly to the people. And it shouldn't surprise us when we get slapped in the face every now and again when we're trying to talk about Christ. I mean, at worst, somebody says, I'm not interested, and you walk away and don't have to deal with anything. Some people get kind of hostile when you talk about Christ, but it's really worth doing because we're trying to save souls. So this helps put it into perspective that things can get a lot worse when you're trying to do what God has asked you to do.
Ed?
Yeah.
Living free is this morning means that we freely give up things that cause us to sin. And we can't know what's going to come to us. But if we're walking and doing what God says, our life will be as good as it possibly can be, as if the king had given himself over and surrendered the way he was told, he would have had a much better outcome than if he did what he wanted.
And you know, I see so many learning lessons just from these three chapters. Especially this next one. Zedekiah wanted to know if there was any word from the Lord, and there are times when everyone, even the wickedest of our society, want answers from one who will tell them the truth. And I think in our country today, I think we see it all the time, just horrible folks. But, you know, when they recognize that you're somebody who tells the truth, they're willing to come to you and ask you questions just because they know they can trust you, because they know you're not going to lie to them like the rest of society does, because our society is full of liars. And we see that here too. Zedekiah didn't like Jeremiah. Didn't necessarily want the best for Jeremiah, but he knew he could trust him. because he had seen the prophecies come to fruition. So it may not be that, you know, it may not be what he wanted to hear, but what we can take from that is we know that these people need to hear it. When somebody comes to you and you just don't know what their heart, you know, their outside portrayal of how they live their life is anything but Christian-like. You just never know whose heart you're going to turn by just listening or giving them the good news. We just have to be courageous enough to do that and to step out onto that limb from time to time, even with people who we think don't want to know, people who don't care, people who've told you before that they're not interested, but who come to you asking questions. People are allowed to change their minds and change their hearts. And that's what we hope for. So, you know, maybe you planted a seed before and now that seed is growing. That's the perfect opportunity to reach out. And when somebody who lives an amoral life reaches out to you, well, then you take the opportunity to do what you can. We see Zedekiah in chapter 38 fearing for his life. He's afraid of what would happen to him if he surrendered to the Chaldeans. So he doesn't listen to Jeremiah. And we see that his end was worse than had he taken Jeremiah's advice. Jeremiah gave him a quick one-sentence answer. City's going to fall, and you're going into captivity. He also gave him an out. Told him, if you surrender, the city won't be destroyed, it won't be burned, and lives will be saved, including your family's lives. But Zedekiah was too afraid to listen. He was unwilling to listen to what Jeremiah had told him. He chose the broad path. That is the path that doesn't bow the knee to the Lord. And it cost him more than he could know. Jeremiah is delivered from his dungeons three different times in our text, from different people. Once Zedekiah, once Ebed-Melech, and once by Nebuchadnezzar himself. You don't know where your friends are until you need them. And it's amazing sometimes the friendships that you make with people who aren't Christians, who really do surprise you with their moral choices. You know, you think that they're just amoral people, but then they make moral choices every now and again. So it's important for us to, I think what we can take from that is not to prejudge people and not to judge that they're not going to do anything to help you. And that you may be able to help them in the long run. Because you never know where help is going to come from when you need it. I think of the story of the Samaritan. The people in Israel at the time that story was told looked down on Samaritans the way that that story was updated in the book we read, that in the book that Dean gave us, where the Good Samaritan was the good atheist, where we put a modern day spin on that, thinking of a person who we least think likely to be somebody who would go out of their way to help other people. And that's the way that the Israelites thought about Samaritans. They were just dogs. They were the dregs of society. But it was the Good Samaritan that stopped and helped the person, took the person to an inn, paid for that person's lodging, went out of their way and spent their hard-earned money to take care of that person. And so you just never know where your friends are until you need them. In chapter 39, we read of Jerusalem's fall and the fate of Zedekiah. And we have discussed these things before, so let us learn from this what the Lord says he will do, he will do. It's important for us to remember that we know that there are things that the Lord has said are going to happen, even in our future, that are motivators for us to be as evangelistic as possible, to get the message out to people who need to know about the Lord. So the Lord has told us that the end is coming, not that it's at hand right now, but that you never know when it's going to happen. So we should always be striving to do the best we can, to use our talents as we've been given.
You know,
and then the final thought I have for you is, just as Jeremiah is finally delivered by Nebuchadnezzar, so we must always remember that others are watching us. We see that Jeremiah didn't know where his salvation was going to come from. And I'm sure the last person he expected to be saving him was Nebuchadnezzar. But we see Nebuchadnezzar specifically told his commander to make sure that Jeremiah was taken care of, that no harm came to him, and that whatever he commanded happened to him should happen. And so we should remember that we're always being watched. And it's important for us to always put on that armor of God and to always try and strive for a virtuous life where we let our morals shine around so people can see that. Any questions, comments?
Ted?
Yeah.
From your first lesson there, where you're talking about, you know, putting our hopes in men, and then number six, let us learn from this what the Lord says he will do. It's too bad today that so many people that will even call themselves religious put all their hopes into things that they want to do, not what the Lord says to do. And they don't realize that when he says that the gate is narrow, that it is narrow, and that all these things that everybody thinks that just because the Lord didn't say that I couldn't do that and they do it, would be changing their minds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's unfortunate. And, you know, it's hard to fathom that there's over 2,000 different types of churches just in our country alone, and 2,000 different types of religion. All these people who think that they're guided by what God wants them to do, but making the wrong choices. It says to me is there's a lot of work to be done.
Yes.
Any other comments? Can't be afraid.
You cannot be afraid to say something to somebody and worry if the person gets, you know, kind of upset at you or maybe even swear at you or anything else. That's just water beneath the bridge. You have to keep going and, you know, in a nice way, and try to let the, you know, as much as you can help a person and then move on. So, but you can't worry about, you know, if the person's going to get upset at you.
Right. Yep. That's as we were told, as the apostles were told, dust your feet off and move on to the next one. You know, we plant the seed. Sometimes you don't get to see the growth. And so it's important for us to remember that we need to throw our seed as far and as wide as we can. You never know who's going to hear it, where that